A lot of you got the opportunity to see Gabe and Amelia get married yesterday, and this was a sweet wedding. I left at 7 p.m., and I heard they danced till at least 10, and they departed in the dark with sparklers. And this is a great accomplishment for Gabe, because this has been in the works for a while. And about a year ago, he was saying he loves this girl. And he was making these lofty claims of this invisible emotion inside of his heart. And she, being a very smart girl, she said, "Put your money where your mouth is. Why don't you go ahead and prove it?" And so he started proving it, and he proved it first with a rock the size of a golf ball on her finger. This was a concrete display of his commitment, and then he proved it in the most amazing way yesterday, standing before all of us, making these commitments of a lifelong relationship and faithfulness to Amelia. This is a beautiful thing. And we saw these invisible claims that he was making, then proven by concrete display. Gabe was doing something that we know well. He was taking something that was unprovable, and then he was taking dramatic actions that then proved the unprovable. This is not unlike what Jesus has been doing in Matthew chapter 8 that we've been tracking through the last 3 weeks. Jesus has been making these invisible claims, these unprovable claims about his authority, that he's the one who forgives sins, that he's the one who is in charge of our eternal destiny. Jesus has been making these lofty claims of invisible authority, but then he's, in chapter 8, he's been proving them with concrete displays of power. And we've seen a series of these concrete displays of power by Jesus in Matthew chapter 8. Earlier in the chapter, we saw him curing diseases, proving his authority over disease. We're going to see today him controlling nature. We're going to see him casting out demons. All of these displays of power are feeding into proving that Jesus is truly the King of Kings, the authority that he claims to be. All of these displays, we've been seeing Jesus' authority and things about Jesus' identity. And then we've also been tracing through these narratives the response of the people. And we've been seeing the faith of the people and also the frailty of the people. So as we look at these next displays of Jesus' power, Jesus controlling nature and casting out demons, we're going to see these same themes. The authority of Jesus, the identity of Jesus, the faith of the people that are participating, and the frailty of the people who are participating as well. I want to offer you as the main point for this morning, and the blanks on the top of the bulletin insert, that in all of these narratives, the more we see the authority of Jesus, the more we'll trust him completely and follow him confidently. This is the results in the hearts of the people that Jesus is interacting with in the stories. And this is what Matthew, as he gives these stories to us, wants us to experience as well. To see the authority of Jesus on display, and as a result, trust him more and follow him confidently. Now, we remember the scene of the crime, the north shore of the Sea of Galilee, the city of Capernaum. Jesus gives the sermon on the mount up in on the hill by the trees, moves down to Capernaum, and he heals the three different people. He has that conversation with about the cost of discipleship, and Jesus then decides, "I'm going to go. We got to get out of these crowds. We're going to go to the other side of the sea." And they're up here on the north side. They're going to be traveling by boat all the way south across the Sea of Galilee. And the Sea of Galilee is pretty enormous, actually. This stretch that they're going to be traveling by rowboat or sailboat is about 13 miles. And if you were looking south from the north shore of the Sea of Galilee, from Capernaum, you can see how far away their destination is there in this place called Gadara. So they're about to make this journey across the sea, and this would take about 4 hours by non-motorized boat, and that 4 hours is with the ideal weather. Now, any of you that know the story in Matthew chapter 8, is the weather ideal? No, this is the story of Jesus calming the storm. So we're going to have everything except ideal weather as they cross to the south side of the Sea of Galilee. Let's pick up as they get into the boat. This is in Matthew chapter 8, verses 23 through 25, and this is where we're going to be parked this morning. If you have your Bibles, I'd love for you to crack them open. Much of the text will also be up on the screen. Matthew 8, starting in verse 23, it says, "And when he got into the boat, his disciples followed him, and behold, there arose a great storm on the sea, so that the boat was being swamped by the waves, and he was asleep. And they went and they woke him, saying, 'Lord, save us, we are perishing.'" So we have this boat full of fishermen, and they comes upon them a great storm. And in this narrative about the storm and Jesus calming the storm and the response of the people, I thought it was cool that Matthew uses this Greek word mega. And he uses it three times to emphasize this is a big story. He says this is a mega storm. And then when Jesus acts, there's a mega calm. And then when the disciples respond, they have mega fear. So he's emphasizing the magnitude of the event that's going on here. And they find themselves in the midst of this mega storm. And waves and storms on the Sea of Galilee were not a strange thing. For the men in the boat with Jesus, this was not a strange thing. Half of them were professional fishermen that spent their entire career on that lake. But this was different. This is what Matthew describes as a mega storm, and it says that the boat was being swamped, and the boat was filling up with water. This situation was so desperate that these professional fishermen were at the end of their rope. All the options were exhausted, and so what do? They wake up the carpenter. They call the carpenter. This is a principle to take away with you this morning. When you all options are exhausted, call the carpenter. And they call to Jesus. He's sleeping, and they say, "Save us, Lord, we're perishing." And I think they're not asking him to row with them or redirect where the sail is pointing so they get some stability. I think they understand they're going down. They're beyond their abilities, and they need Jesus to do something supernatural. And Jesus wakes up. He says to them, before he deals with the storm, he says, "Why are you guys afraid? Oh, you have little faith." Then he rose and he rebuked the winds and the sea, and there was a great mega calm. And the men marveled, saying, "What sort of man is this who even the wind and the seas obey him?" So we see Jesus wake up, stand up, he speaks to the storm, and there is an instant calm. So we're going from this dramatic storm that even the most professional, experienced fishermen can't handle, and it's freaking them out. And Jesus stands up, and with one word, he calms the storm completely. This is a demonstration of Jesus' power, that same power that he used when he spoke a word and he healed the centurion's servant earlier in the chapter, showing his dominating power over disease. Now with the word, he speaks and has dominating power that he displays over even the most intense forces of nature. Matthew doesn't tell us exactly what Jesus says, but Mark and Luke also record this story, and they tell us actually what Jesus said. He said to the storm, "Peace, be still." And with that, the storm that had engulfed the 13-mile wide sea stops on a dime. This is Jesus' power and authority on display 100%. Now, as Jesus is speaking to the storm, there's more going on here than him just exerting power to stop wind and rain. There's something here that Jesus is making an authoritative statement and having authoritative interaction with nature itself. It doesn't just say Jesus exercised his power and squashed the storm. Interestingly, it says Jesus stood up and he rebuked the storm. And the disciples observe not just that his power made the wind stop, but that the wind and the sea actually obeyed the words of Jesus. When he spoke, it wasn't just a display of his power, it was a display of his authority over nature itself. And this points us not just to Jesus' strength, but to Jesus' identity, who Jesus is. And this is what the disciples ask. They ask about actually his identity. Who is this guy? What sort of man is this that even the winds and the sea obey him? And they're asking the question, how do we categorize this guy? We just saw this guy control with his words nature itself. What category does this guy fall into? And we can say for sure this guy is no ordinary carpenter. He's not your average carpenter. And this category that Jesus belongs in, one who can speak to the wind and the sea and they obey him, is an exclusive category. And in the Old Testament, this exclusive category is reserved for who? Who is it that can speak to the wind and the sea and they obey? Yeah, God alone. Look at Psalm 89. This is a psalm about the power and the might of Yahweh. It says, "Who is mighty as you, O Lord, with your faithfulness all around you? You rule the raging sea. When the waves rise, you're the one that stills them. The heavens are yours. The earth is also yours. The world and all that is in it. Why? Because you're the one that founded them." Back in the healing narratives, Matthew pushed us to this question to get us thinking about Jesus' identity. Who is this powerful healer? And then he brought us back to Isaiah chapter 53, promises about the Messiah and his healing ministry. Last week when we saw Jesus presenting the cost of discipleship, we asked this question about his identity. Who does this guy think he is? And Matthew answered with Daniel chapter 7, the Son of Man who has been appointed the eternal ruler over all. I think here, as the disciples are trying to sort out Jesus' identity and understand what category do we put this guy in, it pushes us back, implicitly, back to this Psalm chapter 89. And we see that Jesus is in a category of his own, the category of divine creator, that he is the one, and he's demonstrating it by his power over the wind and the sea, this category of the divine creator. Of course, if the world it was founded by him, of course the wind and the sea are going to obey his command. Now, what kind of man is this? What sort of man is this? How should we categorize this Jesus guy? Jesus is the divine creator. Now, in the boat, the disciples don't quite get it yet. They scratch their head as they ask, what sort of man is this? It's going to be a few months until they're on the sea with Jesus again in the walking on the water scene where they do get it. They do understand, they finally comprehend that Jesus is the divine creator. There they worship him in the boat and they say, truly, you are the Son of God. But this is going to be a few months down the road in their experience with Jesus. But right now, right away, even in the next verses, this is where Matthew pushes us to the identity of Jesus as the Son of God. And it's not the disciples that get it, that understand the identity. It's actually Jesus' enemies in the passage in Matthew chapter 8 where Jesus encounters these evil spirits. And they say, what do you have to do with us, Son of God? So this concept of Jesus being Son of God is introduced to us by the display of his power, controlling the wind and the sea, pushing us back to Psalm 89, and then by the affirmation of his identity as the Son of God. So if Isaiah chapter 53 pushed us back to Jesus' identity as the promised Savior and Messiah, and Daniel chapter 7 pushed us back to Jesus' identity as the appointed ruler of all creation, Psalm chapter 89 pushes us back to Jesus' identity as the Son of God, the Creator himself. What sort of man is this? How should we categorize this guy, Jesus? He is the divine creator. He is the Son of God, the creator himself. This is the first blank on your outline. This is what we see in the story of Jesus calming the storm, that the seas quiet when their creator speaks. Jesus Christ, the Son of God, stands up. Stops the winds and the waves. The sea quiets when their creator speaks. And this is true when it comes from earthworms to earthquakes, from microorganisms to megastorms like the one that we see on the Sea of Galilee. The sea is quiet when the creator speaks. The second blank is a reflection on the response of the disciples, that people freak when their faith shrinks. It's number two on your outline. People freak when their faith shrinks. This is the response and Jesus' explanation of what's going on in the minds of the disciples. He says to them, why are you guys afraid, O you of little faith? And why were they afraid? Yeah, they're about to die, right? Their boat was sinking in a storm. It was being filled up with water. There was some level of justification for their fear, for being afraid. But Jesus says to them, your fear with me here in the boat is an indication that your faith is little. Even when it's justified, freaking out is always a faith issue. You and I, we know Jesus Christ. We know his power. We know his authority. We know his faithfulness. Just like for the disciples, just like for me, freaking out is always an indication of an issue of faith. And Jesus connects their fear with their lack of faith here very tightly. That as they demonstrate their fear goes up, it's very clear that their faith is going down. And that there's a corresponding relationship between faith and fear. He actually has made this comment to the disciples a number of times already, and he will in the future, that they are ones of little faith. And he was observing constantly their fear replacing faith. We already saw it in the Sermon on the Mount when he talked about the disciples facing poverty, and they were having very little faith in the face of this poverty. We're going to see them having little faith because they are running out of bread. We see Peter and the disciples, Peter walking on water and starting to sink, and Jesus identifies it as a result of having little faith. And then when they can't cast out some demons, he says, you guys, this is a result of you having little faith. And he gives in these collective passages where he reveals their little faith, he gives the solution And if you put them all together, I think the solution is this, that if we want to avoid having little faith, the antidote is confidence that God knows, cares, and that he can. That God knows our needs, that he doesn't just know it and care less, but that God cares about us as his children, and that no matter what the difficulty is, God can resolve it. He can bring restoration to our situation. And if we have that confidence, then that will push away fear, that will push away anxiety, and instead it will fill us up with faith. This confidence, you could say this is the faith that displaces fear. This confidence that God knows our needs, that God cares about them because we're his children, and that he can and he will act. And as the disciples were freaking out, Jesus points them back in one of these times where he talks about their little faith. He says, if you guys want to fill up your faith, if you want to have your fear displaced by faith, what I need you to do is I need you to remember. This is the time they were freaking out because they were running out of bread. And he says, come on, guys. Don't you remember the 5 loaves? He had just got done doing what? Baking bread? No, he just got done feeding the 5,000 people miraculously, and his disciples were here freaking out about running out of bread. So he wants them to displace their fear with faith, and he gives them as a tool remembering his power and his faithfulness. He says, he's just pause for a minute, guys. I know your situation seems dire, but remember my power and my faithfulness. And you could fill in this blank. If you want to have your fear displaced by faith and God to fill up your faith, this is a key. And the key is to remembering God's power and God's faithfulness. I wrote a few things down to remind myself, because I want my fear to be displaced by faith. Here Jesus was talking about feeding the 5,000. He says, hey guys, remember the feeding of the 5,000. Hey guys, don't fear. Do you not remember me healing that leper? Don't fear. Don't you remember me turning that water into wine? And remember my power. Remember my faithfulness. For the Grismers, he could point us back right when we got married. Melissa was moving down to California. We were starting our life together. I was a security guard making $10 an hour, and she didn't have a job. She just had finished her master's degree in elementary education, but the school year had already started. And she moved down there, and all of a sudden, a fifth grade position becomes open at the Christian school right down the road from us. She gets hired and starts teaching 2 months into the school year. Don't you remember when there was no job and all of a sudden I instantly gave you a job? Don't you remember, Greg, when you were driving through the deserts of northern Jordan to Urbid and your car broke down in the middle of the desert and you called your friend who lived in Urbid and he said, oh yeah, there's only one mechanic out there. And you looked across the hill and the mechanic shop was right across the way. And then the mechanic came and got the car. I got to meet the guy. The sales manager treated me like a king, drove me around, and I got to tell the sales manager about Jesus. Don't you remember when God made your car break down in the exact right place? Don't you remember when you guys were leaving the Jordan just with the clothes in your suitcases, and then you landed and you had a house fully furnished and the pantry stocked because of the love of local Christians? Don't you remember, Greg? Greg, don't you remember that Sunday not so long ago that you had no jobs for the next week and the home group prayed and by Monday morning you were booked out? Don't you remember? All of the faithfulness of God in the past is there as fuel for our hearts to displace our fear and to give us that faith. So this is what Jesus wants us to do, is to trust in him, to remember what he has done, remember our God stories, and let those stories displace our fear. I want to go a step further to recording God's power and faithfulness displayed in your life, remembering it yourself to displace your fear with faith, and then sharing those God stories, you can call them testimonies if you want, of God's power and faithfulness in your life with one another. Really, that's what much of the Bible is. It's peoples experiencing the power and faithfulness of God. They recorded it so they could remember it, and then they shared it with us so we could have that same confidence in our same powerful and faithful God. This is the solution to fear, is displacing it with faith by remembering, sharing, and recording those God stories. This is the third blank on your outline, something we learn from Jesus trying to teach the disciples, that faith displaces fear when we trust Christ's power and care. We remember his faithfulness, we remember his love, and as a result, faith displaces fear. The disciples didn't get it at the moment. They were dominated actually by a mega fear of something else. And Mark, in his account of Jesus calming the storm, he tells us that the disciples were scared. They had a mega fear, and the mega fear wasn't of the storm. They were afraid of what they had just seen in this power display from Jesus. If you could imagine, the whole sea was covered by this raging storm, and all of a sudden, with the word, it becomes completely calm. The disciples, even knowing that Jesus was on their side, were terrified. But they weren't the only ones that just had observed this mega storm become a mega calm by the power of the Son of God. I imagine that the demon-possessed guys in the next story are waiting on the shore. And they're watching this mega storm, and they see this mega storm turn to a mega calm. And then Matthew tells us that as the sea calmed, they finally arrived at the southern shore. And at the southern shore is where they meet these two men that are possessed by demons. And these demons are terrified. This is point number four, that the rebels quake when the Creator arrives. And the Creator just calmed a storm, and now he's stepping foot on their beach. The rebels quake when the Creator arrives. So we've seen the calming of the storm, the curing of diseases. Now we're into the last movement and this last display of power in the book, or chapter 8 of Matthew, the casting out of these demons. Matthew tells us that when they came to the other side, to the country of the Gadareans, two demon-possessed men met him coming out of the tombs. And they were so fierce that no one could pass that way. Now, the way that Matthew describes it is a very abbreviated description of what's going on with these demon-possessed men. He says that they're fierce, that they were blocking people from using the road. And he says they met Jesus, but this is a very summarized description of what was actually happening. And Mark in chapter 5, he gives us a little bit more of a description of the situation, the intensity of what was going on there in Gadara. He says that this demon-possessed man had often been bound with shackles and chains, and he would wrench them apart, and he'd break the chains and the shackles into pieces, and no one had the strength to subdue him. And night and day among the tombs and on the mountains, he was always crying and cutting himself with stones. This is a pretty intense situation for the man, but then also for the entire community. This guy, because of demon possession, had lost his mind. He lived in the graveyard. He cut himself all night long. He would be screaming at the top of his lungs. You talk about a rough neighbor. You ever had a bad neighbor? Right? This guy, I'm sure the whole community was terrified of this guy. I wouldn't let my kids go out and play or go for their donkey ride in the afternoon, because I'd be afraid that they're going to run into this crazy guy who not only is tormenting himself, but he's also tormenting the community. And he's not just some guy that's lost his mind and lives in the graveyard. Actually, Matthew records a little bit more of the interaction between Jesus and this demon-possessed guy, and Jesus asks, what's his name? And the guy says, we are legion because we are many. And it's actually the demons responding to Jesus that are living inside this guy. And I don't know how many the many is, but it's not just one demon. It's a bunch of demons. A legion is 6,000 soldiers. So I don't know if there's 6,000 demons. What's going on here? But this is an intense, terrible, terrifying situation. Matthew tells us that this demon-possessed man and his friend come and meet Jesus. But Mark tells us that actually when they saw Jesus from afar, he ran and fell down before Jesus, crying out in a loud voice, what do you have to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High? I adjure you by God not to torment me. And they begged Jesus. So this isn't just running into Jesus on the road. This guy isn't copying an attitude against the Son of God. This guy's falling down on his face, and these demons inside this guy are falling down on their face in front of the Son of God, begging him not to bring judgment on them. They understand who just arrived on the shore. And if you read all of these accounts, these demons are actually terrified of Jesus, and rightfully so. They understand his identity. Even if the disciples are still scratching their head trying to categorize Jesus, the demons are not confused who just arrived. Jesus not only has authority to control his creation and with the word make a storm stop, but Jesus has the authority to judge his creation and to judge his enemies. And these demons know that for sure. And while demons cannot read your mind, demons can read the Bible. And they know exactly what their destiny is. They know the where of when they're going to be judged. They know the when of when they're going to be judged. And they know the who. And they know at this moment that they're standing in front of their judge. The one who one day is going to condemn them to eternity in the lake of fire with their leader, Satan. And they're terrified that he's there to take care of them early. Matthew tells us, behold, they cried out, what have you to do with us, Son of God? Have you come here to torment us before the time? They're terrified of what Jesus is going to do next with his power. Matthew tells us what Jesus does next. He says, now a herd of many pigs was feeding at some distance from them, and the demons begged him, saying, if you cast us out, send us away into the herd of pigs. And then he said, go. So they came out and went into the pigs, and behold, the whole herd rushed down the steep bank into the sea and drowned in the water. Is this kind of weird? This is a very strange story. Jesus seems to be being nice to these demons. Instead of crushing them, he sends them into the pigs. But I don't really understand why didn't they just graze and eat pig slop for a while. They instantly go and they jump off cliff and kill the pigs they just got sent into. This is what happened. And we say, praise Jesus, Thank you for sending the demons out of this poor guy into these pigs. Now, one of the other gospel writers tells us that there's about 2,000 pigs in this herd of pigs. This is beyond the scope of my imagining. I can imagine 20 pigs, kind of. 200 pigs, it's getting a little bit out of control. 2,000 pigs. I mean, this is an enormous herd of pigs. If you could imagine filling up a basketball court full of pigs, and then, that's a lot of pigs, right? Imagine them. And then filling up a second basketball court full of pigs, and a third basketball court full of pigs, you're about at 2,000 crowded pigs, and then sending them jumping off a cliff. This is what we have. For the pig farmers down there on the south side of Galilee, this was no small hit to their business. This was very dramatic for them as well. And I think of the demon-possessed guy and the excitement of the demons going out of him. I think the herdsmen, the pig farmers, were thinking more about the pigs than this crazy guy, because modern equivalent, this was about $500,000 worth of pork drowning in the sea, going to waste. So we have this dramatic moment where this group of demons, thousands of demons perhaps, that are inhabiting this one guy, are sent into this huge crowd of pigs. I don't know if the pigs' eyes turned red and their teeth came out. I don't know what was going on, but this seems really freaky. And then they start freaking out and they all go and jump off the cliff and drowned. Theologians describe this scene as Oscar crazy. Etymologically, this is a combination between awesome, scary, and crazy. And this is how I feel about this story. And it seems that the people watching, who were herding the pigs, they felt the exact same way, because it says that they ran. They were out of there. It says that the herdsmen fled, and going into the city, they told everything, especially what had happened to the demon-possessed men. And behold, all the city came out to meet Jesus. So they went back and they reported this display of power by Jesus. And now everybody's coming out. And I'm hoping, as I read, that we've got another come to Jesus moment, like the woman at the well. Remember when she met Jesus and then she went back to her town and she told them about him and that she thought he was the Messiah. And they all came out, and many people in the town believed salvation was spreading to the Samaritans because of the testimony of the Samaritan woman. And they invited Jesus, hey, come back and stay with us. I was hoping that we have another come to Jesus moment here, as the town comes out to meet Jesus. But Matthew tells us just the opposite actually happened. It says when they saw him, they begged him to leave their region. They were terrified by Jesus. Also, actually, Luke tells us that's why they sent him away. Luke says they asked him to depart from them because they were seized with mega fear. They were terrified of what they had just heard and what some of them had just witnessed as well. So Matthew's account ends with them kicking Jesus out of town. This is the end. That's a terrible ending. Have a nice day. So Matthew ends with the disciples freaked out, the demons scared, the pigs scared, the villagers scared. Everybody is scared. But the good news is one crazy guy actually gets saved. And I think this is what the whole boat trip through the storm and this whole incident with the 2,000 demonic pigs was all about, is Jesus seeking and saving this one lost crazy guy. This is the last point on your outline, that Jesus chooses and uses the most unlikely people. And Matthew doesn't tell us what happened with the formerly demon-possessed guy who is living in the graveyard and cutting himself up. And you say, I don't believe that God could or would save a guy like that. That's going to happen when pigs fly. But Jesus did. They did, and Jesus did. If you're here and you have not put your faith in Jesus, know for sure that if Jesus will save this crazy guy, he'll save you too. There's nothing you have done that disqualifies you from the mercy of God. There's nothing in your history that makes you outside of Jesus's reach. Jesus came to rescue, to seek, and to save the lost. He came for us crazy sinners. He came on a rescue mission, and he came and he paid the penalty for our mistakes. He paid the penalty for our sins when he died on the cross. He paid our debt to God the Father in full. All he says is, come, put your confidence in me. Put your trust in me. I will grant you full forgiveness of sins and a place in God's family forever. It might be you this morning that God is choosing the unlikely person to bring to him by faith. This is the last moment on the outline, and I'm so glad that Mark told us the rest of the story. He says that the man who had been possessed with demons actually begged Jesus that he might be with him. He instantly became a dedicated follower of Jesus Christ. And this is a come and follow me moment. And we've seen Jesus inviting people to come and follow him. And you remember last week, he invited them to come and follow him, but count the cost and know how much you're going to have to sacrifice if you want to follow Jesus. This come and follow me moment actually turned out a little bit different. Jesus didn't tell the guy, okay, give everything you have to the poor, come and follow me. You know what he told the guy? He told the guy, actually, stay where you are and follow me. Jesus actually did not allow this guy to join the team. It says he did not permit him to come with him, but said to him, go home to your friends and tell how much the Lord has done for you and how he has had mercy on you. So this guy, instead of Jesus sending this guy out or calling him to come join this traveling band with Jesus, he actually tells this guy to stay home. Go home and follow me. Go home to your friends and tell them about my mercy, my power, my love for you that you have experienced. Go home to your family. Don't go off to Africa. Go home to your family and follow me. Help them know about the love that I have for you. Help them know about my mercy. Go back and tell them your God story so that their faith can be replaced, their fear can be replaced by faith. Stay and follow me. Now this is all happening in this little area around the Sea of Galilee, down on the south side in the orange. And this guy did what Jesus said. He went home and he testified about what Christ had done for him. But do you know what? This guy did not stop there. God used this guy in shocking ways. When Mark notes what this guy did, he just gives a sentence, but this is a dramatic sentence. And it says, he went away and he began to proclaim in the Decapolis how much Jesus had done for him, and everyone marveled. So Jesus and the disciples leave. They go back to their business in Capernaum, in this little town on the north shore of the Sea of Galilee. This guy stays. He goes home. He tells about Jesus' mercy to his family and friends. But then he goes and he begins proclaiming in the Decapolis. You know what the Decapolis is? It's this entire region, this 10 Roman cities that spread throughout Jordan, Syria, and Israel. This crazy guy that had encountered Jesus, experienced the power and mercy of Jesus, then becomes the first wave of missions to the Middle East. Right? He was the first one to go to Syria and tell them about Jesus. He was the first one to go to Jordan and tell these guys about Jesus. This is amazing. This guy's taken from a madman in a graveyard to spreading the message of Jesus throughout the Middle East. He brought the message of his own experience of Jesus' mercy, him seeing the power of God on display, and he spread this amazing message about the reality of the authority of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. I hope you've enjoyed this last few weeks looking in Matthew chapter 8 at these demonstrations of Jesus' power, proving his authority. I hope that you've seen in the healing of the diseases, his control of nature, and now casting out of these demons, that Jesus is the one that deserves our complete trust and deserves our full confidence as you and I follow him. This is Jesus Christ, the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Let's pray. Jesus, we thank